Hello and welcome to The Rest is Education. I'm David Marshall and I'm delighted to be here today with Hilary Plant and John Ansell. Welcome Hilary and welcome John.
Good to be here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Just to introduce you, Hilary is a local authority governor at a North London primary school. In addition to being the vice chair, link governor for SEND and inclusion and wellbeing governor, she is also professionally a practicing psychotherapist and has worked for many years in public health as a cancer nurse, researcher and senior manager. John is an expert trainer specialising in data machine learning and data science and an integral coach who's worked for numerous schools and education groups on one-to-one coaching with leaders, mostly in the independent sector. Generally, we talk to teachers and leaders within schools. This is an opportunity to talk to you both who are not in schools all the time, who are working outside of schools and have careers outside of schools that don't touch on education so much. What you both do, I think, is integral to supporting schools in this area, because we are talking about a crucial area of well-being and mental health, how we can support staff, not just teachers. And for that, my feeling is that schools and school leaders need help. I think there is some crisis points we've reached. I had a look around and seeing what sort of surveys and things there was at the moment, and I found that according to the TES Teachers Wellbeing Survey, the wellbeing survey from March this year, 74% of teachers considered leaving education in 2023. The Education Support Survey from November of last year found that wellbeing is at its lowest point since 2019. Of the 3,000 staff surveyed, 78% said they were stressed. And when you look at head teachers, that rises to 95%. Obviously, as we go through, I'll be talking a little bit about my experience as a teacher and colleagues' experience. But from what you're seeing, why do you think this is important that we're talking about this?
It's interesting hearing those stats. They're quite alarming. Those are really, really alarming statistics. And it's interesting in terms of nearly with all the clients I've worked with, that sort of thing does come out, particularly in heads and particularly in deputy heads. And I've often tried to sort of like wonder why certain professions, and I think teaching falls into one of these brackets where it's very almost non-stop. This, you know, particularly during term time, it's kind of got that level of intensity to it, and that's really tough. And you know, and it means there's going to be a lot of stress. And the thing from there is, what I always find interesting is that in my experience, stress primarily comes from not taking action that you do have some control over. And almost in these types of roles, you almost need specific sort of like, you know, awareness or training of some sort to help you manage that, because it isn't so common across so many, you know, so many kind of like other roles out there. And also it's just, you know, it's an incredibly important role in terms of like, you know, we're talking about our children here and the future generations, all of these things. So there's the pressure too. But for me, it kind of really stands out that level of intensity. And basically, like, how can we better support people in those really intense roles? And education just stands out as one of those where it really does have that, you know, that almost it's just constant all the time. And you just can't switch off, particularly, you know, during term time. So,
yeah. And there's probably multiple of reasons for that. We can sort of dig a little bit deeper into them. Hilary, I thought...
It's a truly shocking statistic that 95% of head teachers are feeling very stressed. It's shocking, isn't it? And I'm sure that does apply to all staff. I mean, there's different people are stressed about different things. And there's an exodus from the profession, as I understand, as well. And it's not just about money. It's about stressful working conditions. And the intensity of the work and the responsibility of the work, as John's saying, and the lack of agency and control because of all the things that are being thrown at teachers all the time, which perhaps we can go into. But it's fundamental, isn't it? The well-being of children is dependent on the well-being of the staff who teach them, who care for them at school. And if the well-being of staff is low, if they're stressed, then this impacts on a whole generation of children. So it's very fundamental that we think about this and think about, I suppose, it's what's causing it, as you know, as we're saying, beginning to say. And there's no easy fix for sure. But what are some of the things that we can think about that might day to day alleviate some of the issues and perhaps some of the bigger things that can be done in schools as well?
Building there on what one of the things that you said, Hilary, is like the irony is that often the best way for anyone to learn something is by seeing the example that's being set. And if pupils kind of like see overworked, stressed out teachers, admittedly probably some of them put on a good face, but it's like, you know, that's not the greatest message to be sending them either, which again just like really emphasizes why this is so important.
Yeah, and we could start by talking about workload, because this is a crucial one, and we talk about teachers having heavy workload, and then linked to that statistic of head teachers or principals having, you know, 90-95% being stressed. There's another level of workload for head teachers. The idea of, well, what do I work? I go in at 8 o'clock in the morning, well, a bit before eight, and then I leave probably about 5:30, sometimes six. I think that's a decent amount of time for a day. It doesn't feel too much. But as John was saying, that intensity of the day, probably more what affects me because of the sheer number of things I'm dealing with across the day, which may be very different. They're not just me standing in front of a class. They might be me working with, you know, other teachers, leading kind of sessions or doing a lot of admin, emailing parents, that kind of thing. So that's me as a teacher and also in a kind of middle leadership role. But heads seem to have this kind of like, there's this probably anecdotal, but from the sort of heads that I've talked to, there's just it, the day starts kind of at 5 a.m. for many people, and it doesn't stop, you know, when you go home at six. I would say I'm pretty good at getting home. And
I was going to say, you're yeah, pretty boundaried from a lot of the teachers yeah, I've worked
I
with.
Am,
that, that's actually
yeah,
very healthy.
Yeah, no, I do work on weekends, and I work some evenings. I obviously have to do like lots of parent focused evenings and other kind of open evenings, which is pretty normal, pretty mandatory for being a teacher. But I think I'm quite good at putting some boundaries in. But I've been teaching for nearly 20 years now. So I think there's also a lot of speed that I've got up with myself. So I'm just talking from my own experience here, but I'm still feeling the intensity of the workload.
But I think it is the blurring of the boundaries, isn't it? I mean, I'm really glad, David, that you are good at putting a boundary around the end of your day. But I think one of the issues these days, and it probably particularly since the pandemic, is that blurring of the boundary. And of course, it is particularly for head teachers, for senior school leaders, but also for teachers with marking and lesson planning, particularly more junior teachers. I think there is a, you know, it's so easy to work at home, isn't it? And respond to things and emails and somehow it seeps into every aspect of life. So there's the intensity of the day, which never quite cools down, never quite finishes off. So it sort of carries on and then carries on into the night. You don't sleep and then you're up early in the morning. And it's a sort of never ending stress cycle that seems impossible, I think, for some people to get out of.
And I had an interesting conversation a couple of weeks ago with a colleague where he was saying to me, oh, you don't have emails on your phone. And I said, no, I've never had school emails on my phone, for the very reason that I can still get them if I'm at home, but I would have to get onto my computer, obviously get into the secure sort of access site and look at them and then close it down. I can't just look at them on my phone. It's crucial that I can't do that, because if I get one email, I don't want to deal with it then, but I'm not going to stop thinking about it. So as I'm trying to get sleep or in the waking up in the morning, particularly if it's something that's quite urgent or needs a bit of kind of thinking, it's going to really affect me. And I don't want that. And sometimes I just don't check my emails at all on the weekend. Checked emails probably twice today and it's a Sunday, but nothing's come in, which is great, but it might do.
Yeah.
And but if you're head, or if you're the DSL, which for those who aren't in education in the UK, stands for designated safeguarding lead. You could be also a deputy DSL. Those are the people who get the calls that may come in at 9 p.m. or later, 11 p.m., 5 in the morning. You may have something that at any time that comes in, that is an urgent matter that needs dealing with right now. I've had this experience of ringing a DSL and then picking up at 9 p.m. on the first ring. Wow. And in order for them to do that, they must be just right next to their phone and ready to respond to anything. And I was impressed. They were great. But it was still that kind of level of responsibility. It's quite a lot.
But it is responsibility is the word, isn't it, actually? You've talked about intensity, but it's also such a responsible job. It's such a vital job that doesn't stop. It isn't just between 9 and 5, but it should be just between 9 and 5. But it doesn't stop. And I'm going back to blurring the boundaries again, which, and you're talking about DSL lead, but I think it isn't just them. I think staff, depending on their sort of individual approach to work, if you like, can get caught up in thinking about it, being available, being ready all the time.
That's so interesting, because it is, and this is where maybe, like, you know, something that can be worked with, because you mentioned the word individual staff there. And that is the thing, in terms of, there are some roles where it really is, you don't have a choice. But maybe there are some roles in teaching where there is potentially the power of choice, but the example that's being set, the habits that have formed, or whatever, just that person's personality, they do that. And that's, you know, in terms of, like, you know, if I'm thinking about my work, that's the realm which I can operate in terms of, like, okay, we can look at that. And I'm sure of you, you know, you as a therapist too, in terms of, if you're thinking of some of those, like, those deeper behaviors that have been defined by aspects of life, you know, working with those part that can then help kind of change what's going on in the now too. So
maybe let's look at this a bit deeper, because I think I would like to move us on to talk about later on about collective workplace ethos and culture. But for now, we're talking about very much about individuals. And let's say that I'm an early career teacher and I've done my initial teacher training, but I'm still kind of like learning, as it were. Maybe I've even done my, you know, I've done my sort of time, if you like. I've got everything signed off. I'm officially a teacher, don't need to go through probation anymore. But it's still within a couple of years or 3 years of sort of starting teaching. And I'm taking on a bit of responsibility maybe, but I'm finding the marking, or I'm finding the sort of behavior management really challenging. So if I come to you and say, oh, I'm really can't stop thinking about work. I seem to be working every weekend. I seem to be working several nights a week. I don't think I'm good enough. I don't think I'm doing, you know, what could be said to somebody who's in that position? How do you start with a conversation with somebody who's kind of finding just everything too much?
I suppose the first thing to do is to sit with them and listen to what they're saying, really listen to what they're saying, because actually in saying it out, sometimes you'll get a bit of self-understanding. And also to acknowledge, you know, I think if, depending who the person doing the listening is, I think to be acknowledged of how you're experiencing work is also in itself very, very therapeutic, and quite a sort of holding thing to do. And of course, we've just started talking about boundaries, so I guess that would be a place to start, to think about sort of drawing boundaries and recognizing some of the patterns that you're working with, and then listening and thinking through. I mean, you mentioned marking. I mean, I'm not a teacher, but as I understand it, marking is one of the stressful aspects of teaching. And I know schools introduce things for helping with marking, and that sounds important. So, I mean, you know, what are the trigger points? But then it's also sort of knowing yourself. What helps you? What helps you relax and calm? Is it taking a slow, deep breath in the middle of the day? Because actually, or several times a day, that does really help some people, you know, a bit of distraction, having fun, going for lunch with somebody, you know, another, you know, not skipping lunch, looking after yourself, I think is pretty fundamental, you know, just making sure you do take a lunch break and eat something.
Yeah, no, I agree with you, Hilary. I loved what you said there at the start too, about just simply voicing. I love looking at studies on this thing. And there was this wonderful study that was done on, it was actually a therapy session, but I still think it's applicable, where they measured the brain and the heart electrical when the session was going on. And what really stood out is that it was most heightened when the client was speaking and the therapist was listening. And in any of these kids, there's always about almost creating the space for someone to be able to feel that they can talk. But if that can be created, almost the first step, it is just almost talking about it, David. So like in terms of like, you know, almost the key thing that you said there about someone struggling, they've just started and they're finding it too much. Just the first step of simply talking and voicing it can be the start of something. But with anything like that, and again, just Hillary touched on many of the things here, everyone's different. Everyone's different in terms of how we are. And, you know, whenever I'm kind of like faced with a client or, you know, a teaching client in this sense, there's always the service issue, which I kind of call the tip of the iceberg. And then there's all the iceberg beneath. And this is all the things about us in terms of how we are as human beings that have shaped maybe that behavior. And in terms of like why we react in different ways. Now, I know it's not directly answering your question, but it's because it's almost... there, alas, isn't a one size fits rule. It's not as like as simple as just like, if you do this, you'll be okay. Because we are all a bit different. There are certainly some like key behaviors. Again, Hillary mentioned boundaries there. It's just so important. And like being a bit disciplined, taking a bit of space when you can, just switching off just for those little moments can make such a big difference. But it is hard to just simply say, and you know, this is what you can do with that person, because we are all unique human beings in our own ways.
And I suppose just to add, we're talking about the individual, but it is also about school culture. A person may not, a teacher or whoever, may not feel ashamed or embarrassed or a failure or not good enough because they need to talk about how they're experiencing their work. And for that to be sort of allowed to safely and non-judgmentally happen. So yeah, as you're saying, John, the talking is really important. It's feeling safe to talk, I guess.
Yeah, completely. Because if you don't feel safe, it's just, it doesn't nearly have the effect, no. You know, especially if there's anxiety that's going to be in there too, it might just exacerbate it.
So from both your professional experience, there's a real importance on the listening to people's individual situation. And from what I'm hearing, there's also, John, as you were saying, there's no one size fits all, there's no one answer, but listening's got to be the starting point for anybody. But Hilly, as you mentioned, and it's so important, there's a bigger lens to look at here, which is and the whole school culture. Possibly we might be talking about multi-academy trusts, which are, you know, often up to maybe 10 or even 14 or 26 schools, and sometimes that culture can be set from, you know, by a whole country, the DfE, Ofsted, which is the inspection arm of the DfE. We can talk about those cultures as something that has a direct impact on the individual and how the individual feels. So the tragic death of Ruth Perry, the head teacher, she took her own life. And there's been a lot in the news in the UK since then about Ofsted. That's opened up a lot of this conversation around the pressures on schools, on heads, to live up to some idea of what they have to be. And if a school has to get to a certain point of what the government expects it to be, that means the people who are getting it to that point are the teachers and the leaders. And that pressure, you know, accountability is a great thing, but that pressure and that sort of single word inadequate or even good, you know, we think good is a good word, but actually for many head teachers, the word good can feel like someone saying you're inadequate.
Especially when you were outstanding before.
Exactly.
Good is bad.
Good to anyone outside the teaching profession might sort of sound, oh, that's great, we're a good school. And don't get me wrong, I know teachers who've said to me, yeah, we've got requires improvement. That's completely fair. We've worked really hard to get requires improvement because we were coming from a place that it was inadequate, right?
Yeah.
So it's all relative. But if we're coming back to the culture, we can say that the culture can be set from within a school, within a trust, or within a society. That then sort of comes back to the individual.
I mean, I've been Ofsted as a governor. Awful. I mean, I've also been inspected in the NHS. I guess what we can't do with our conversation here is sadly change that framework of inspection, or we could try and influence it. But I guess it's how we can reflect on what schools can do themselves or individual staff can do themselves to try and reduce the catastrophic feeling, you know, about the approaching of Ofsted. And it's what can one do to sort of calm that or other things? How can you institutionalize? I was going to say safety measures, that's not quite the word, but support measures so that it doesn't brew up to be such an extraordinarily stressful situation? Because, I mean, you know, we can say in the end it's just a word. In the end it is just a word. But it means so much.
It does. And there are changes that are happening. So the link between pay and performance, which was always kind of sketchy since around 2014 or so, that's kind of being dropped completely. I believe that from September, there are definitely going to be, I've heard there's going to be a lot more emphasis on mental health for teachers. And exactly, Hilary, what you're talking about, that idea of blurring the boundaries. We know that there's a big focus coming in on children and iPhones and technology and AI, and this is really going to be enormous sort of coming from the DfE for children. But I think there's also going to be some things in there about staff as well. And I think this is going to be reflected in Ofsted. Their language has shifted. There's definitely a lot more kind of said about well-being and mental health and the importance of looking after teachers. Now, my experience from schools is that it's one thing for it to be an official, and I'm going to choose this word very carefully, tick box for schools and for wider, but it's another thing for it to be meaningful. You know, I've been talking with Ross and Aaron, who are the two co-run this podcast with me, and Aaron said, you know, what I find really challenging when there's a staff meeting, for example, and we're chunk of it is all about well-being, and my, you know, it might include mindfulness, it might include where to get help, and then, oh, and here's a dozen other things you've got to do, and also you're in a meeting which people are talking about well-being, which is taking up your evening time. You get the feeling from that that well-being has just been put on your to-do list along with about 10 other things, and so there's no extra time, but somehow you've got, the school has told you in no uncertain terms that your well-being is important to them, and now please can you make sure your well-being is okay. We're now handing this responsibility over to you, and here are some resources that you could look at. You know, there might be various things, here's an app that you could try. I know that many schools have come much further from that. And John, from what you're doing, that I know that schools and academies are employing coaches and supervisors. But I still think that you can offer somebody an integral coach and then tick that off your list. I've had this experience of it can look like a culture that is supporting staff well-being for any inspection. And then as a teacher or as a TA or a member of staff, you can still feel exactly as stressed or if not more than you before this intervention. And so for you in the workplace, it can feel like nothing's changed. School leaders are looking at their performance. That can look ticked on the list. There can be a big bias gap between what school leadership as a whole think that they've done and put in place and what the teachers and staff actually feel has fundamentally changed.
I'm passionate about this because it really comes down to strong leadership. And it, in terms of, again, in my experience about what stands out when staff are in a better place, it's about the leadership.
And we've already said that, you know, we you know, because I'm putting emphasis on the leaders, you know, tick boxing, but we've already said that we know leaders from the evidence of often more stressed than the teachers. So we're putting this on the people who are themselves perhaps at the kind of point of being sometimes overwhelmed.
Yes and no, because it is also, if the leader is setting a lot of those kind of like really healthy examples, and again, I appreciate there's always going to be an extra level of stress and pressure that comes from someone that is the head, but a really, really healthy leader also has trust. And with trust means that you've got an SLT team that can really support and help. And then beneath that, people support and help. Because so much of what I see is this idea, it's all on me. It's all on me. And it, you know, people kind of keep a lot of their struggles to themselves. Now, when there's a really healthy work culture from the very, very top down, they're generally, in terms of like, you know, what I've observed, I do find that the teachers are in a better place. Because there is that greater boundaries and people do share so much more and they speak a lot more. So yeah, there is going to be that little bit of extra pressure, but in the same sense, a really, really good leader will also be willing to kind of delegate. And so it isn't necessarily all on them, and that will kind of like almost ripple through. And I had a great example, and there isn't too many details in here because we spoke about like the the Ofsted inspections, and a client was talking about, she was driving somewhere completely the opposite direction to her school, and the call came in, Ofsted inspection, and she almost had a panic attack. You know, it was that sort of level of anxiety, like making calls every minute on the way back, turned around straight away, and they got through it, but it was pretty intense. And then 4 months later, there'd been a change. They'd kind of learned from this experience. The same thing happened. She was a little bit calmer this time. She came back, she rushed back, and everything was all in place, because there'd been this lovely change in the work culture. And it was just this wonderful moment of just like, John, I really trust my team. They all really stepped up out here. And just, and you know, you could tell that they, you know, that they felt empowered to step up. So it can make a big difference. It doesn't necessarily have to just be like that level of intensity and pressure is just on the leader to do all these things, because it takes a while for that culture to really adapt and change. But it can make a difference. It can make a difference.
I think I completely echo what you're saying, John. And I think if staff, if team feel trusted, feel respected, have things delegated to them, if they feel they have agency, I think that improves well-being for the whole team. So it is the sort of role modeling, but feeling trusted and respected, and just gives this feeling of more agency and control. And if you make a mistake, well, you learn from it. You know, nothing's, mostly it's not life and death.
Yeah, mostly, yeah.
I mean, I had a very senior leadership job at the end of my NHS career, and I did a job share with someone I'd known my whole career, and she was fantastic for me, because I used to be terrible at blurring the boundaries, and she was so strict about it, and she used to make me I'm a stop, you know. And in the end I got in the habit of it, of not replying to things out of hours, and not, I'd almost be scared that I'll just sneak it in somehow, and you know, she won't notice that I'm looking and I'm doing this, that and the other. But in the end I stopped, and everything was so much better for me, and I think for our team, because of those sort of the trust and the delegation and the not jumping at every single click that happened.
The trust element feels really resonant with me, because in my professional career as a head of English, or as a head of a section of a school, the stuff that we managed to do that was really brilliant in the schools that I was working in was never me. It was always because of a team coming together, that collaboration, that communication. It didn't always work the first time, maybe didn't work the second time, and it took a while to get the kind of relationships right, or the sort of balance right. But when I look back and think, oh wow, that was something I've achieved, I can never say I, because the things that I achieved on my own probably didn't last, or didn't really have a, you know, significant impact long lasting. The things that we achieved as a team was so integral that they'll still probably be going, even I might have left a school a few years ago, because there's ownership. There's a researcher called Matthew Kraft who does a lot on career professional development, and he talks about culture as being, it's lived by the staff. Everybody has to live the culture. And I'm paraphrasing here a bit. It's not obviously just a piece of paper. It's not a policy. If we're talking about a well-being culture, what can schools do? If we're talking about single schools, or talking about, you know, a setting like an academy, what are some simple things that you think schools could do to start creating that well-being culture?
I'm sure I'll have more to say. I'm sure John will. But there was just something I wanted you to pick up that you just said, David, about communication. That's a really fundamental plank for well-being. And you mentioned your team and good communication, and that I didn't quite understand what you did, but whatever you did.
It wasn't me. It was communication between...
Yes, exactly.
You are part of the team, though.
Yes. Part of the team, yes.
So clear lines of two-way communication are really important. And I think that really does help well-being, because people know where they are and they can talk about it up and down, or side to side, or together.
I think, it does start with the leaders' communication, and then enabling the sort of middle managers and the teachers to find that space to communicate and to talk and to listen to each other.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard, isn't it? Because you've always got to try to think in terms of like what would help, also balanced with what's practical. And this is the whole challenge, and you know, kind of like almost across the sector when it comes to this idea of like, you know, what can schools do more of? In terms of when I have seen it make a difference, is when there is an acceptance that something isn't right here. And there's been some pretty, in some cases, pretty kind of like drastic changes. And often that comes down to, is talking about kind of like changing the culture, but it is training. When it comes down to it, in terms of like, and you know, that there will be budgetary kind of like restraints there, but real training in terms of, particularly with the leaders, can make such a big difference. And really, at the core of that training, it does come down to well-being. Well-being combined with boundaries, because it's this whole idea that people think that, you know, they have that kind of like the push on through mentality. I must do more, I must do more, I must do more. That then inevitably leads to burnout. And it's this whole kind of like idea, and studies have been done on this, is that when there is that healthier work culture, when people are more aware of work boundaries and all the things we've spoken about, communication, it does create more productivity. So is that sort of thing. So specific sort of like training, and you know, you've mentioned coaches and things like that. For me, I think every single school should have, I'm not quite sure what the role would be, whether it be counselor slash coach slash some sort of, you know, support staff, just an additional member to that team, and just that person being in the company, because I think that itself could make such a big difference. Just know that there is a person there that people can go to. And then also just more specific training in terms of just like, okay, what are healthier work practices? What are the things that we can do here? There's loads and loads of stuff out there. And I think that can make a massive difference.
And what do you think about things like having a staff council where staff can meet and talk about issues and maybe as a way of changing things if they're supported by the leadership team and the things that they're suggesting? Do you think things like that help?
I mean, David, I'm sure you might have a view on this, but
Yeah, I mean, he
so
doesn't
for
really.
me, do I look like I have a view on it? I have a view on it. Yes.
Yeah, I could see it. I could see you looking around.
Yes.
I'm
So
just interested.
for me, it's a big yes. But other God, I'll let you
It's a
speak
hard
to David.
yes. We have one at our school. It's a hard yes.
Yeah.
It's a really great thing because there's a line again of, it's actually communication. It's a line of communication directly to the leadership and the governors, which I think, done the right way, can be a good conduit for feelings of frustration and not being listened to, because there can be a teachers have line managers and we have performance reviews. No, this is what happens in a school, outside of inspection, but there has to be some other conduit for, you know, there is this issue and I want to feed it, because this is not just affecting me, and I think it's a bigger deal for the school, and I think it could be affecting the children. So very much a hard yes to have a staff, we call it a staff consultative committee. I love the idea of having some kind of staff well-being person whose job and responsibility it is. And that's actually, I was looking at the Anna Freud Institute, which has some great stuff I will post alongside this podcast episode, about some things that schools can do. And one of the things it recommends, as well as having a policy on staff well-being, is to have a person whose job it is to sort of look after staff well-being. Hilary, I mean, we are both governors at the same primary school, and you are the, what's your official
Yeah,
title?
so I'm actually the outgoing well-being governor,
You
but yeah,
are, yes,
I am.
sadly.
I've been for a long time, so absolutely. And I think, I mean, just as a governor, it's a lay role, but it's quite a powerful role in a way, because you can influence culture by listening to staff and by hearing what they're saying. You can feed it back to the governors. I did exit interviews with all the staff that left the school over the last 6 years, and they can then be fed back to the head teacher, to the governors, highlighting any issues raised. I mean, we have pretty stable workforce, but people do say when they're leaving of things that maybe could, help their well-being, and I'd be particularly interested in that. Yes, I mean, the school also has a well-being lead teacher, so together we would think about things. I'd have a termly meeting with her.
And I think that's those these are good indicators of a school that is thinking about well-being, culture, and how to support staff mental health. And another one is having a staff room. In an age when budgetary cuts and numbers of children can mean the staff room is reduced in size or cut sometimes completely, I think it's crucial to have a space where teachers can sit away from the pupils, where teachers can go on their phone, need to be, because there are things outside of the school only happen within the school hours that you need to sort. You might need to sort something to do with your children's welfare, you might need to sort something medical, or you just need to sit there and have a cup of tea, a cup of coffee, and have a chat with someone, have a grumble. Having a grumble is so important. I think I wish all leaders of schools understand that when staff sit and moan about something, it is very rarely personal to the leadership. It is very much just needing to get it out.
Having a laugh is also important, isn't it? Moaning, laughing,
So important.
breathing.
A staff room can be a place where teachers can get their breakfast if they've got a microwave. They can also, my school is an independent private school. It has free tea and coffee and biscuits and free fruit. And wow, you should see how fast those bananas go in the morning. They just disappear. But it's important aspects of well-being. Now, look, I'm not expecting cash-strapped schools to fork out for free bananas and oranges and stuff, but it does make a difference to the general day-to-day well-being.
It's a sign of appreciation, isn't it? I
It
mean,
is.
it's
Not
not
all schools can
bananas,
afford that.
yeah, but some things don't, just an opportunity to moan or have a laugh, space.
That's actually more valuable, yes, to have that space. So these things make tangible small differences to your day. Workload, we've already talked about. We haven't talked about pay. I went to a governor's conference, actually, a North London governor's conference, where Sam Friedman was talking, and he's worked as a researcher and policymaker, and he's currently sort of writes a lot about education. But he's also, interestingly, a governor at a school in North London, and he talked quite extensively about pay and finance. And his feeling was that one of the big reasons why we have a teacher crisis, Hilary, you mentioned this earlier, we have a teacher retention crisis at the moment in the UK, as many countries do, is pay. And you can't get around the fact that we have spiraling cost of living and things aren't getting any sort of cheaper. He did feel that pay is a big problem, and particularly if schools are, having to sort of tighten the budget a lot. And unfortunately, he also feels that in the UK, we've got an election coming up barely a month away. He did feel that in the future, there probably isn't likely to be a lot more money for schools. There's no real plan by whatever government takes over to sort of put more money into education, which I think is pretty dispiriting for those who know that education in the UK is in a very difficult place financially.
And it is a tricky one. I mean, it's funny. I know, kind of like almost going back there, but the point that you're making about the staff room, and it is funny how like someone will just see something on a spreadsheet in terms of where can we save money, and maybe that's somewhere we can save money, but not appreciating the importance of the difference that things can make. And for me, there's almost like with anything, there's about laying down the foundations. And again, it always comes down to leadership. But in terms of having a space for people to be able to step out of their day, that is so important. And if that then helps the well-being, it then helps the teacher manage their stress levels because they can just do that and just step out of it just for a second. Trust me, that school will see a difference there. But alas, in terms of, again, it takes that awareness to be able to take a step back and have a look in terms of, yes, we've got our constraints. What is it we can work with here? But really appreciating the importance of what those things are. And then trying to work out, kind of like identifying, okay, that one's almost a non-negotiable.
We don't know what's going to happen with teacher pay, but as you're
No.
saying, it's unlikely to go up. But it's all those other things that you can do within a school to support teachers, whether it's, the staff room, the staff council, listening, acknowledging, appreciating, trusting. All those things don't cost any money, perhaps you could say.
And can I ask, could you think of or recommend any organizations who work with schools, or are there sort of websites or individuals that you've come across who schools could look to? Where do schools go if they're going to sort of start looking for help with this outside of the education world?
Yeah, I mean, this is this is an area that I work in, and I'm not the only person that works in this area. You know, there are now coaches, leadership coaches, trainers that, you know, have a speciality with working with schools because there is such a great need. So obviously I'm only one person, so there's only so much capacity I've got, but you just need to put my name in Google and coaching and, you know, I'll come up. But it would be kind of like looking in that area, it's becoming a little bit more of a recognized kind of like profession, and there is more of a support network there. Alas, it costs, which is again going to be some of the challenge, but it is again, you know, what is the most important thing there?
There's the education staff wellbeing charter, which is on the gov.uk website. That's actually got quite a long list of resources that are available that schools and teachers and staff can access. I mean, I think if you listen to teachers, most of them will say, you know, if you give me a website or give me a thing, you know, they often find it hard to take that first step to do it, because feeling really stressed then to sort of do something else almost feels more stressful. I mean, I think the resources are there, and perhaps, you know,
it's more for leaders and for leaders, because, you know, if I'm a teacher and someone gives me a website, I'll not look at it. Or if someone says, hey, try this app, I'm not gonna look. I'll be really honest. But if I am a leader who's got all of this survey back from my teachers, whenever we do it, I think, you know, schools tend to do this stuff in the summer term because they know there's absolutely no way you should send out a well-being survey in December. I mean, that would be a terrible idea. Definitely not at the end of a term. So your kind of probably May time is a great time to send your well-being survey out. But even if you send it out in May, it's still light. Teachers are getting home in the light, there's some sun, and we're coming towards the end of the year, and you're still getting back really negative feedback, then you know there's a problem. So it's more like the, you know, what I do, I think, Hilary, is I'll link in what you mentioned into this, the episode notes, so that, you know, people would say, okay, I need to look for a coach, I need to look for some advice on this. By the way, look, I'm assuming that many heads are already all over this. They probably know a lot more than me about where to sort of find this stuff, but I still think it's useful to have it up there and to say this,
for sure,
because there's a lot out there, and I think that, you know, there's probably a lot of people who frankly might not be that helpful, companies that aren't that effective, that schools could churn this money into, that they don't really have to spend into something which isn't going to make an impact.
Yeah, and I suppose in the end, if you've got no resources, you've got it is just about saying to your colleague who's looking stressed, now, how are you? Are you okay? You know, just kind of simple human reaching out, which when you're stressed yourself and under a massive, intense workload, we tend not to do.
Just the other aspect here is that, you know, you're so right, Dave, in terms of, like, you know, it's a mindful, there can be so much. I think it's also important about identifying the need. And I guess what I mean by that is in terms of where is it going to be most effective? And again, just my point of view, it's at the very top. If you get the training right at the very, very, very top, that does cascade down. I know it'd be great if we could do all of this throughout, but if there was going to be one place for me, it's like, if you get the leadership kind of thinking in a different way and really embed that healthy culture, that's what can make such a big difference.
I'm going to pivot, because we're sort of coming towards the end of this session now, just to kind of ask you a couple of personal questions. I'm going to ask you, right, what do you love about the work you do in supporting schools mainly? What do you enjoy about it?
I absolutely love being a governor at our local primary school. I love the kids. I absolutely love the kids. They're fantastic. And so they're sort of everything. But what's been deeply rewarding is forming relationships with staff and getting to know them and getting to understand and seeing that as a governor, actually, you can make a difference. And a lot of that for me is in supporting them in what they're doing, which is, it's very rewarding.
Brilliant. Yeah, I completely agree with that. Yeah, being a governor is fantastic. I'd recommend it to anyone.
I mean, for me, it can be so rewarding. Just so rewarding, because I'm well aware in terms of the impact that I can have. I can't change necessarily how a school's gonna go about things. The only thing I can do is, you know, work with my client and also be very honest with you, they're the ones that do the work. But when they change almost how they react to some of those really intense situations, when they look deep within and saying, why is it that I did this then? Why do I do that then? Why am I so conscious of what other people think about me? Why do I always think the pressure's always on me? And then helping them see what's really going on there. And then coming to those beautiful moments of realization where it's not just they've realized it in themselves. They've come to me, you know, like, you know, one of our later sessions. They said, John, I did this, or rather, I didn't do this because my team did it, or something along those lines. And it's just so rewarding. And, you know, you feel like you've made such a difference there. And it is, without a doubt, the most rewarding part of my work life in terms of that sense there, and supporting people through it. So, yeah.
That's wonderful. And that's a great place to stop. Thank you so much, Hilary. Thank you, John, for being here. It's just been a really, I think, nourishing conversation for me to hear both your experience, your recommendations, and your advice. And thank you.
Thank you, David. Well, great to meet you, John.
It's been a real pleasure and good to meet you, Hilary.
You've been listening to The Rest is Education. I'm David Marshall. You can find us on LinkedIn. You can find us sometimes on Instagram, and you can also email us at therestiseducation@gmail.com. Tune in next time for the next episode.